And while I'm saying this, let me just be honest and let you know that I don't love you. I never did. You know, I only did what I was doing because I wanted to go to heaven.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, find out who this strange new voice on your podcast is, and Kim Ellington talks to several authors who presented at the Black Nonbelievers 5th Anniversary Celebration in Atlanta last month. Paying attention to the Humanist Hour for any length of time, you probably think of Bo Bennett as a fixture, part of what makes this show what it is. As of the end of January, however, Bo has left the show to move on with his own projects. The American Humanist Association and the crew of the Humanist Hour would like to take just a moment here to thank Bo for all he's done for the show as producer and as interviewer. I'd like to thank him personally as well. I'm Stephanie Zavan, the new producer of the Humanist Hour, and I couldn't be happier with the crew and the legacy Bo has left me. I've got some work to do living up to that. If you haven't already, check out Kim's interview with Jen Wilson on our January 20th episode. Jen is brand new to the show and excited to get to work. You've heard Peggy Knutson for a few months, of course, and we'll get you properly introduced to her soon as well. And, of course, Kim Ellington isn't going anywhere. As for me, who I am and my plans for your podcast, have a listen to this interview I recently did with Jen.
Hi, everybody. You're listening to The Humanist Hour. This is Jen Wilson, and I'm here with a special introduction. If you're a regular listener, you might know that Bo Bennett, after a fantastic two-year run, recently passed this torch to Stephanie Zavan, our brand new producer. Stephanie, I'm very excited to work with you and to welcome you officially to The Humanist Hour.
Thank you, and I am very excited to work with you and Kim and Peggy. This is an amazing crew.
We have a heck of a group, don't we?
We do. There's so much enthusiasm. I can't wait to actually get a chance to channel that into things.
Oh, it's going to be great. So tell us a little more about you and your background that leads you into your identification as a humanist.
So I actually, for mostly political reasons, identify primarily as an atheist. And I'm one of those weird people who grew up without religion.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were both of the fairly conservative bent of Methodist, or at least their parents were. And that caused them enough problems as they were growing up. They decided they didn't want to do that to their kids. So they would just let us kind of absorb what was going on in the culture around us. No church, no proselytization, no, you know, telling us we were or needed to be any particular religion. Mm-hmm. And then when we grew up, we'd all get to choose what we wanted to be.
It's interesting. Mm-hmm.
And so far, none of us have chosen a religion. So we're, you know, 45 years into this experiment and having some implications I don't think they expected. So, So my perspective on the atheist movement, to start with, is a little different. I really am strongly politically motivated to... Mm-hmm. identify as an atheist because, I say because of church-state separation issues, but I don't necessarily identify or focus on all the same ones that other people do.
Sure.
Among other things, I am an abortion clinic escort. I just recently started doing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really big church-state separation issue.
Absolutely.
But one that atheist organizations haven't traditionally focused on, which is where the humanism comes in, because atheism only gets us so far. And frankly, the traditional focus of atheist groups is exactly what I'd expect for people whose focus is on atheism. And that's fine. And we need that. And we need lots of resources for people who are coming out of religion and may have been damaged by it, or may have had to give up a lot when they left their religion. I support all of that. But a lot of my activism is more humanist focused at this point, because I think there are important things we need to address.
Understood. Yeah, those cultural ties and the way they span generations, it's really a fascinating topic, and it can become a heartbreaking one as well, especially the way things get ground into us in an election season.
Oh, this election season.
It's something, isn't it?
It really is. I love all you people. I agree with 99%, but sometimes I don't want to talk to you.
Oh, gosh. Well, on the Humanist Hour, we're excited to cover a wide spectrum of topics with you as a team, and there are some terrific ideas in the works that we've been batting around. We've heard a little bit about the topics that interest you personally. What are you especially passionate about? What do you hope to bring into the podcast?
There are a bunch of things that I'd like to address, because I think humanism, and particularly more traditionally conceived humanism than maybe humanism that we've seen in for a lot of the last decade, gives us an amazing scope, because it is that combination of we want to make sure that people can flourish as human beings. And that covers so much. But at the same time, we want to make sure that people aren't under any religious coercion or other kinds of pressure that make their lives harder. And then there's the skepticism, which I think broadly as humanists, not necessarily particularly any humanist organization, but broadly as humanists, we don't pay enough attention to, because all those things we want to accomplish, we have to know how to get there. And we have to have good information to get there. I described myself fairly recently as a wonky radical. A wonky radical. I don't believe there are things we can't do, but it's really important that we know how we get there. And so the kind of skepticism that we apply to, political issues, that we apply to the issues that affect people's everyday lives. You know, what does it really take to provide a decent education that allows somebody to flourish when they grow up? All those kinds of questions also fascinate me.
Yeah, critical thinking is such a huge component of the perspective of reason that so many of us as humanists really try to promote in our lives. So how do you feel? I know there has been a lot of flurry in our culture about anti-intellectualism. And do you have any thoughts on that? Kind of a broad question, I know, but
I definitely see some trends that way, but at the same time, I feel like there is also a lot of talk about anti-intellectualism that is kind of an appeal to a golden past that doesn't exist.
Absolutely,
we, particularly in the U.S., have always had strong strains of anti-intellectualism in our politics and in our cultural discourse. So they concern me, and I definitely want to work against them. But I maybe don't put as much emphasis on them as some other people. And part of the reason that I don't do that is that I've seen too much up close of what happens when people think that, this is a hard thing to say, being anti-intellectualism is enough to be intellectual.
I understand what you mean. Yeah.
When people identify as a person who opposes anti-intellectualism, that doesn't give them the tools that we all need to really effectively fight anti-intellectualism and to grapple with our own biases and our own, you know, all the weird quirks that our brains still have, even when we're smart. put that in air quotes so that you can't see. Smart people who study things. I mean, there are just as many things that trip us up. And and sometimes I feel like fighting anti-intellectualism is, shall we say, preaching to the choir in ways that don't necessarily really help the people who are listening. Mm-hmm. So I often put my focus on what I call smart people problems.
Smart people problems. I like that. Any other strange facts about you that you'd like our listeners to have in mind?
For folks who don't know me, this is not my first podcasting gig. I've actually been doing live radio for Minnesota Atheists since 2009. I've been one of the hosts of a show that, called Atheists Talk. And let me tell you, I, particularly having a bit of a cold at the moment, I can't tell you how happy I am to have a chance to edit out every time I cough when I'm interviewing somebody.
It comes in handy.
It does. So yeah, I've been part of Minnesota Atheists for quite a while on the radio show. I was on the board for a couple of years as associate president, running some conferences, not by myself, because that's not a one-person job, but running some conferences for them. We ran the Secular Women Work Conference this past summer, which was activist training using the voices and the talents of people who do a lot of quiet work in the movement and get overlooked, namely women and genderqueer people. So we pulled together about 2 days worth of talks and panels and workshops. Everybody on stage was female or genderqueer, and it was just this most amazing conference that we had. So,
oh wow,
yeah, yeah. I told you I'm wonky. I get really excited about activists coming together and talking about how to be activists.
Oh, it's fantastic. There's always more than the sum of its parts when you get people together like that. It's invigorating.
It is, and projects suddenly happen, and it's all wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. All for the betterment of humanity, to help people thrive, as you said.
I certainly hope so.
Absolutely.
We'll see. It's not the easiest thing to measure.
Of course. But I am so excited about the work that you do, and I'm excited to work with you in this team. I think we have some fantastic times ahead.
I think we do.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on board, and onward and upward.
Thanks, Jen. And for today's show, the first under new management, we bring you a little something special. Hope you enjoy it. You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zvan. Mandisa Thomas founded Black Nonbelievers Incorporated in 2011 in response to the uncomfortable reception Black people often receive in the U.S. atheist movement, and in order to focus on the needs of people who are often faced with a choice between their cultures and their conscience when it comes to matters of religion. From its birth in Atlanta, Black Nonbelievers has grown rapidly with affiliates across the country. While Black Americans still have some of the lowest rates of atheism and agnosticism, the non-believers among them are getting organized very quickly. On January 16th, Black non-believers from all over gathered together in Atlanta to celebrate their growth and their accomplishments. They had a full day of panels and workshops, topped off by the kind of party you can only have when you finally get to be surrounded by the people who understand and face all the same challenges you do. One of the day's panels focused on Black atheist and humanist authors. No, not Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. Contemporary Black atheist and humanist authors. The boom in publishing non-believers isn't just for white people. Kim Ellington attended the Black Non-Believers celebration, and she took the opportunity to talk to these panelists. In the following interviews, she asks them what brought them to atheism and what brought them to writing. Here are her interviews with Frank Edwards, Ronald F. Murphy, Daryl Smith, and Cheryl Abram. If you're in the market for a new book, one of these authors should appeal to you.
I am here at the Black Nonbelievers 5th Anniversary Celebration in Atlanta, and I am with author Frank Edwards. Hello, Frank.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Frank is the author of the Jupiter Strong books, and if you don't know them, you're about to find out, but I bet a lot of you do. And I can't even tell you how excited I am to be sitting here next to the author of Jupiter Strong. So tell us, for folks who don't know, tell us about Jupiter.
Jupiter is the five-year-old heroine of the Jupiter Strong series. She's the youngest of the Strong family, and she's the focal point of the entire series. And what we tried to do was build a platform where we could transfer positive images and kind of edify children who otherwise were being malnourished in that respect. And so we wanted to focus on the community that we serve and live in. And so Jupiter Strong was created.
So what was the catalyst to these changes for you?
I guess it was a long time coming, but the aha moment was a conversation with my daughter. We were talking and she said to me, "Daddy, when am I going to get my princess hair?" And I was like, "What do you mean? You know, you already have your princess. You were born with princess hair." She says, "No, when is it going to turn yellow and start to hang down?" And, you know, I had a broken heart. And so I had to really focus on what was causing her to feel inadequate. And so I went into her room and literally cleaned house. I took everything out. The funniest thing, I remember specifically taking down a clock because the battery fell out and fell on me. And it reminds me of Newton with the apple, right? So we took out all the images that didn't look like her, that she couldn't relate to. And we started slowly kind of building a base of things that were more gratifying for her and something that fell in line with what we were trying to do. But at that moment, I knew that I had to take my skills and talents as a writer and apply them and with this newfound purpose. And here's Jupiter.
That's awesome. So tell us a little bit about Jupiter. What is she? Does she get into shenanigans? Is she a mystery solver? What's her story?
Jupiter is, she's very brave, very, very curious. That's one of her main attributes. And the reason that she's able to be so curious and brave is because she is incredibly protected on all sides. And that's one thing that we really wanted to convey in particularly African-American young women. There tends to be a sense of, I don't want to say worthlessness, but less value. And so I wanted to really make sure that I could get into the young girls now that you are incredibly valuable, so much so that you're worthy of being protected. And so Jupiter is, she loves recess. Jupiter loves yellow cake. That's her favorite thing. She's incredibly innocent. And so it's to the point where, you know, everybody can love Jupiter. She's like a little cherub, right? Her little fat cheeks. And so Jupiter is definitely very outgoing and adventurous. So yeah, she definitely gets into some things. Jupiter travels the world.
That's awesome. So where can our readers find these books?
At www.jupiterstrong.com is where you can go. It's exclusively where you can go to get the paperback copies. But if you prefer a digital copy, then they're across all the major formats. So Kindle, Google Play, Nook, so on and so forth.
So all the little ones can have it on their little scrolly screens.
Exactly.
That's awesome. Is there anything else our listeners need to know about Jupiter or any of your other work?
Well, we are close to putting out kind of a spinoff from Jupiter. Jupiter has an older brother named Eldritch. And so that one's going to be a little bit more geared towards the boys and have kind of more of a comic book art style. We're really excited about it. We thought it was going to be a first quarter release, but it looks like it's going to be second quarter. There's that. And then for probably not quite 2 years yet, but approaching 2 years, we've been working on the cartoon. And so that will be coming soon. So I would say if you can now, go ahead and go follow us on Facebook, go to our website and sign up for the mailing list because we've got a lot of exciting things coming up.
Yeah. So
we're pretty excited.
That's awesome. Fantastic. So folks, this is Frank Edwards. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I am here at the Black Nonbelievers 5th Anniversary Celebration, and I'm here with Ron Murphy. Ron, tell us a little bit about why you're here this week.
I'm here actually to speak on the authors panel, and there are several other great authors that were up there. We all wanted to tell our story and how we ended up writing our books and how we came to those decisions to write them. My book is called The Everyday Atheist, and it really chronicles my journey from coming from a mainly secular home, going to an historically black college, which was very, very religious, and then embracing faith, adopting faith, and growing in with a religious belief. From that point, it was several years into the faith. I was very, very much immersed into it. I came to Atlanta. And in Atlanta, the churches were bigger than they were even in North Carolina. So I went to New Birth Missionary Baptist Church. I went to Quiver Dollars Church. And these are mega churches with tens of thousands of members. And I was actually just blown away by the size and scale of these churches. But again, I felt like certainly I was doing the right thing, and I knew what I was doing. But I began to have doubts. And as those doubts emerged, and as I began to voice doubts and questioning specifically some of the claims that were being made by the church, that's when I ran into some massive opposition. I was shunned for even suggesting to look for some evidence or authentication of why I should believe the way I do. And so I didn't get any answers from the church. And so I decided I'm going to have to go on my own to learn those things. And, you know, I'm glad that I came up during the internet age, right?
Right.
Because if it weren't for the internet, I'm not really sure what I would have done. I probably, like many, started Googling it. And on YouTube, I became a huge fan of the Matt Dillahunty show, The Atheist Experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm sure many people have heard of it. He's very, very famous. And it was... That's exactly how I felt, this notion of people making these claims and then really not being able to back them up. So I started investigating, and I read all the popular books, whether it was Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, Sam Hatter's Letters to a Christian Nation, Christopher Hitchens'
God Is Not Great.
God Is Not Great, yes.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I think that I criticized a little bit of the atheist movement was the notion of the complexity in which it's always being presented. I think a lot of times, as atheists, while we embrace science and we embrace logic and reason and evidence, I think sometimes when we talk to non-believers, that's the first thing we go to. It's our go-to, first arrow we have in our quiver. But the problem with that is I think we're intellectually distancing someone from the conversation, and that's not what we want to do.
Right.
We want to keep them engaged and keep them listening to what we have to say and not tuning out because they don't even understand the topics that we're talking about. And my reasons for leaving religion were very simplistic. When they made the claim that the earth is 6,000 years old and everything else said the opposite, I didn't know how we could maintain that belief. When they would be frustrated with someone making a claim, let's say President Bush says, God told me to invade Iraq. Okay, so... But they would be frustrated with that decision. And I'm like, well, isn't that the inherent issue or a problem with faith? The notion that anyone can make any claim and say that it's from their God because it can't be verified. And so that also had an issue for me. And I always wondered, because I said to myself, well, did the Pope get the same message from God? Did any of the other famous religious leaders that exist throughout the nation, did they get any of these religious claims? And from that religious side, they were pretty silent about that claim. And so that was another catalyst that made me really, rethink this whole religion thing.
Mm.
But ultimately, I think a lot of people think atheists choose to be atheists, that we sit down one day and say, I want to be an atheist. Like someone says, I want to be a skier, or I want to be a chess player. And so they go out to start learning how to play those or do those things, activities. That's not the case. In most cases, especially for the ones that were strong believers to begin with, like I was in terms of becoming a believer in college, I think many of us, it's a dissolving away of belief. After a period of time and so much information that's in the contrary. It's not just, it's the presence of contrary evidence that was the biggest thing for me. It's not just the absence of evidence, but the presence of contrary evidence. And that was the biggest thing for me. It's not, okay, we don't have any evidence for this, and so someone's making an assumption. It's not only do we not, we actually have evidence for this, and the claim that you're making is contrary to that. And that's what made me, my beliefs slowly dissolve over a period of time until I realized I didn't have any. And that's when I realized I was an atheist. I was agnostic for about 6 months, and then I realized that that didn't make any sense, largely because, obviously, agnosticism is the belief that the God question is unknown or unknowable. But the problem with that is, I said earlier, I didn't believe in Zeus or Poseidon or Horus or any of the other gods that lived throughout all of creation. I wasn't agnostic about any of them. I just believed they didn't exist. But I couldn't understand why I was making that a different decision, an agnostic decision about the religious God in my community, the Christian God. And then I realized it didn't make any sense, and so I abandoned it. And it was, at the initial time of doing it, it was very exhilarating. It felt great to let go and just to not believe. And, you know, as Richard Dawkins says, you know, we're all atheists. I just go one God further, right? And so, yeah, so anyway, but being a black atheist is tough. Many, as one of the other panelists talked about, dating in the black community. Well, dating is terribly hard. Every time a female finds out that I'm an atheist, that's the end of the conversation. Except to berate me and tell me that I'm going to hell, and that I'm a devil worshiper, and I eat babies, and all these other kind of things. And, you know, I'm an equal opportunity dater. I date outside my race. But when I do that as well, it's even harder, right? Because that young lady now has to go down to their parents and say, you know, you thought him being black was the kicker. No, he's actually an atheist as well. And so that makes it even harder to get accepted in with those families and communities. So
you could do an updated version of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because now it's like there's two struggles that they're going to have to overcome. It's like, and so, yeah, so it's you know, I talked, it was interesting listening to everyone else, because everyone else on the panel has kids. Everyone else mm-hmm. in the panel was, you know, I guess maybe married or in a relationship at one time, and yet, no, that's not my case. I don't have any kids, never been married, et cetera, and then largely because it's just so difficult to date out there. And I think there's a lot of people that embrace that. In my book, I talk about some of the hot buttons. I was like the notion of Christian nation and how it's incorrect, how a 9/11 was a game changer for a lot of people. And I also talk about criticisms of atheism in and of itself. Some of my criticisms of atheism are, I think sometimes some of us will actually attack someone else's longstanding belief. We know that people believe in them wholeheartedly. And so I don't have any problem promoting atheism, but I don't have to promote atheism with it. In other words, I know I'm probably an atheist, but I don't have to be an anti-theist.
Gotcha.
And so, but that's just my personal take on it. I also have an issue when atheists always espouse reason, logic, evidence, science when it comes to the notion of the religious question. But when it comes to politics or for almost anything else in their lives, then they're just as emotional and making just as emotionally based claims, logical claims, as everyone else. And I think, you know, for me, the byproduct of me becoming an atheist is then I apply that to everything. I'm actually working on a second book now where I'm arguing that the greatest detriment to mankind is not nuclear proliferation or clean water or global warming. It is reason. The greatest detriment to mankind is reason. All of those things we talk about, let's say global warming, for instance, it's not that the issue is too difficult. It's not that we can't come up with clean energy, whether it's, you know, geothermal, hydroelectric, solar, wind, whatever, or to work on to pour billions in the next generation battery technology and require cars to be all electric by 2025 or something like that. That's not the issue. The issue is that there's a good bunch of us, there's a portion of the population doesn't believe it exists and that it's man-made. So, and that's an issue with reason. When it comes to something like war, it's because it's financially beneficial for some people. It's about a need of some kind, either for more territory, more power, more money, you know?
Yeah.
And so if through reason is the way that we would divorce ourselves from those ideas and then hopefully get away from the byproduct or the catalyst of war. So anyway, that's the next book that I'm writing. But it's always from the everyday perspective. I think there are times where what frustrates me when I look out at any particular issue is that you have to have someone for one side and then someone for the opposite side, instead of two people just searching for whatever the truest answer is, whatever answer is supported by the most evidence. And so I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I think the issue, the institution, the political engine has its own issues. And we need to address those in and of itself. So we get our money from the Federal Reserve, and they're a big conglomerate of banks, then, you know, how do we bite the hand that feeds us and look out for the self-interest of the masses?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't hear any president, Republican or Democrat, really kind of talking about those kinds of things.
That sounds like a good book. I want to read that one, too. Now, where are people going to find The Everyday Atheist?
It is online everywhere. It's not in bookstore, but it is online everywhere. New Falcon Publications was the publisher that produced it.
Can we find it on Amazon?
Absolutely.
Can we find it? Do you have a website as well?
I do have a website. It's www.ronaldfmurphy.com. I was originally going to go with The Everyday, but they said if you're going to write more than one book, just use your name. So, kind of new to this process, so I'm trying to go from there. But yeah, I definitely encourage people to pick up the book. I want the feedback, right?
Right.
Good or bad, I want the feedback because it helps me become a better writer. It helps me hone in on my next book, on what I want to do next, my
Excellent.
Next project.
All right, listeners, that's The Everyday Atheist. This was Ronald F. Murphy. You can go to ronaldfmurphy.com or Amazon and get the book. And you can go to remembersmile.amazon.com, and you can give money to a good cause as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to The Humanist Hour, I'm Stephanie Zavan. On today's show, we're featuring interviews from the Black Nonbelievers Incorporated 5th Anniversary Celebration in January.
I am here at the Black Nonbelievers 5th Anniversary Celebration in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm here with author Cheryl Abram. Hello, Cheryl.
Hello.
So tell us about your book. First of all, it's called
Fire and God.
It's Fire and God. So yeah, not too much controversy there.
No.
All right, well, first of all, the name, where did that come from?
That actually, it came from a conversation that I had with God, where I said, you're fired.
There you go.
And right. Yeah. I also said, fuck off, but I didn't want to put that in the title.
Yeah. It's hard to sell that way, right? So your background is religious?
Yes, very religious. I'm from Southern Louisiana. Grew up extremely religious. The whole family, my aunts and uncles are pastors and deacons and, you know, on the church usher board, all of that stuff, you know, the whole nine. So just grew into that culture. And I learned to depend on it. I learned to love it, you know, because it's where community was. Everything was centered around the church. So, it's really something that I loved and never in a billion years would have thought that I would walk away from.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you enjoyed it. It was great for you.
Yeah. So up until a point.
So your book tells us about that point.
It does. So Fire and God is just my story. Like, I'm not telling the story to change anybody's mind about how they feel about religion or anything. It's strictly, this is what happened to me. And the reason why I want to share it is because I felt like it was a good thing that happened to me. And when good things happen to people, they want to share it with others, you know, whatever that good thing is. So that's really what it's all about. I just want to share my joy and happiness with others. And I did that through this book.
That's great. Tell us a story that led to your deconversion.
Right.
Or your reconversion, as I like to call it.
Right.
I'm a lifelong atheist. So for me, I'm like, you're on my side.
Yeah.
Not that it's side, and all you Christian friends, I love you.
Right.
You know,
right. Well, it was several things that happened. I was in the Baptist church. There's something called being saved, where you go in front of the church and you ask God to forgive you of your sins and stuff like that. So I did that when I was 12, and which was fine. I mean, at 12, I wasn't sinning a whole bunch, you know, so things were, you know, they were fine, right? But it's when I left home. I left home when I was 18 to go to the military because I needed money for school. And my family wasn't able to afford it. So, you know, I went into the military strictly to get money for school. And I did. Mm-hmm. But when I went away at the age of 18, I had been so protected by religion. I didn't know how to live, you know, outside of that, without the church there and my minister there to, you know, keep me in place and to ask questions of and things like that. So I experienced a whole bunch of things in the Army that I'd never, you know, experienced before. And I started to stray away from what I'd been taught. So I started going to clubs because I found that was nice. And I discovered when I left home that boys thought I was pretty, you know, and I'd never experienced that before, you know, and they were saying things to me, you know, and I was engaging in, you know, their pelvic sorcery that they like to, you know. So, you know, like all that stuff was going on, right? So I felt bad about it in one regard because I knew, you know, the Bible said you can't do that and I was going to hell and all that. But on the other side, I was like, you know, this feels good. Like I like hanging out with people who may not be Christian. I like laughing at jokes and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. That it felt natural and good. So, you know, so time went on and it was a struggle for me. Was it the church or the world? What are you going to do, Cheryl? Are you going to be a devout Christian? Are you going to be this other person that's, you know, just enjoying life, right? And in all that, you know, other things started to happen. I had really bad relationships. My financial situation got really, now at this time, I'm like in my 30s and, you know, things like that. So at the age of 12, I really didn't know what it meant to suffer.
Yeah.
Maybe I had an argument with my mom or something and it was over. But when you're in your 20s and 30s, and now I'm 40, suffering takes on a whole nother level. It's a whole new thing, right?
Yeah.
So all of the time I was thinking, you know, I'm suffering, I'm going through all of this because I left the church. It's my fault. God wants to help me. You know, he wants to get me out of this situation. He wants to heal my body. He really, really wants to do all of that. But he can't because I'm preventing it because I'm not being a good girl, you know, and doing what he told me to do. So for years and years and years, I'm trying all kinds of things to try to get back to where I was when I was 12 years old. And God loved me more than, you know, more than anything. I was one of his chosen and all this other kind of stuff. I didn't want him to be disappointed in me, you know, and all that stuff. So I'm trying different churches. I'm giving more money in church. I'm praying more. I got my husband to go to church with me because I'm like, you know, you got to do this. If we're going to live right, you know, you have to be a part of it. So I'm trying all these things and nothing's happening. I'm still, my house is still being foreclosed on. I'm still at this point with my second husband getting a divorce, you know, and it's horrible. It was a terrible situation. And it was exhausting. At that point, I was literally, physically, and mentally exhausted with trying to live. And life was just so hard. And I thought, why is it? That's all I want to do. Like, the birds live. The fish live. I just want to live. That's it. You know, it was an uphill struggle.
Yeah.
So the fateful day was when I came home and I went in my kitchen. There were just all kinds of correspondence on my kitchen counter from, you know, the foreclosure notices, notes to appear in court, divorce stuff. I mean, just bills, everything was. And I can't do it anymore. I'm done. I'm through with it. So I had a book in my room about somebody who had overcome or something like that. So I went in my room, you know, to read it because I felt like, let me read the story of somebody who's been in my position and came through it okay. Because I don't feel like that's going to happen for me. So if I can read that somebody else went through the same thing and was okay, that'll make me feel better, at least for this moment. So I started reading the book. Don't remember the name of the book, but the guy who wrote it, he was saying stuff in it about, you know, you got to get all the Stephen King books out of your house because that's how the demons get in and stuff like that. I had heard that before. That was nothing new to me at all. I'd heard it before. But reading it when I was in such a low place, it really brought on a lot of fear. And again, it was, Cheryl, it's your fault. At that point, I was done. I was like, you know what? And this is where the title comes in. You know, I was like, I started talking to God. I was like, I'm finished. I'm done with you. No more Bible. Not going to church anymore. And while I'm saying this, let me just be honest and let you know that I don't love you. I never did. You know, I only did what I was doing because I wanted to go to heaven. I don't trust you. I'm not even sure if I believe in you. So you're fired and you can fuck off. I'm done. And I was, well, part of me was scared at that moment because you're not supposed to talk to God like that. You know, I was waiting for the lightning and all that stuff. But at that point, I didn't care. I was like, I don't care. Because all I had left, the only thing I had left was the truth. All I could do was tell the truth, you know. And that was my truth in that moment. Yeah. I don't know you. I don't love you. I'm done, you know. And there was a physical feeling of being released from chains. Like, really. I really felt it was like if you're born carrying a weight, you don't feel it until that weight is taken away. And then you know, oh, my God, you know, that's exactly the way it was. And it was awesome. It was totally awesome. And that just, you know, led to more searching and questioning, you know, and things like that, you know. So I was finally, over the years, it's been about 5 years now, just able to go through that journey. And it was very scary. It was a very terrifying journey because, as many people have said today at the conference, belief, I was made of belief. Like, that's who I was. And when I finally let it go, I felt like I was dying. Like, it was like a death. Because my identity was God. It was the Bible. It was all of that. And if you to take that away, it was like an empty shell. It was like nothing was there. So, but it took me unlearning all that to find who Cheryl really is, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where I am today. And another reason why I enjoy telling this story.
Absolutely. That's great. So you had a book that started to help you, and now you have a book that helps other folks,
yeah.
Which is fantastic. So again, this is called Firing God.
Yes.
And where can folks find this book?
They can go to my website, CherylAbram.com, CherylAbram.com. And also on my publisher's website, New Harbinger Books. I don't know how to spell Harbinger, yeah. So yeah, just go, yeah. Just go to my, or you can Google it and share it.
You probably put it in New Harbor, it'll come right up. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, perfect. Cheryl, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I am at the Black Nonbelievers 5th Anniversary Celebration here in Atlanta with author Daryl Smith. Hello, Daryl.
Hi, how are you?
I am fantastic, thank you. So you have written a book.
Yes.
Yes, tell us about this book. What's it called?
It's called Black Nuns, You Are Not Alone.
Nice.
Yes, and I wrote this book because when I first acknowledged that I was an atheist, and by the way, I acknowledge myself as an atheist, and I'm provocative about using the term atheist over the other monikers. Not that that defines me, but when I talk with someone, particularly someone that's a believer, I want them to understand exactly where I'm coming from. And when I wrote the book, I talked about with my children when I came out. I have 5 grown children, and none of them knew it. They said, well, how can you be an atheist? Black people are not atheists. You know, there's no way. And I don't know any black atheists. And you know, I told them, well, yeah, there are quite a few. And I said, you probably talk to a lot of people that you don't really realize that don't believe, they just don't acknowledge it. Because one of my daughters is, she's an atheist. And when I came out, she told me that, well, you know, Poppy, I really didn't believe that stuff when I was a little girl. And, you know, and it's just so exciting to hear you say that now. And my other 4 children, my 2 sons, one son is a Muslim, he belongs to the Nation of Islam, and my other 3 are all Christians, but they just say it with their mouth. You know, they say one thing, but they do something completely different as based on the religious upbringing that I brought them up, and my wife and I brought them up. I grew up in a religious family. My wife, we belong to the AME Church. We raised our children in the AME Church, and it just that when I got to the point where I was just trying to find out which made more sense, and I was, you know, a little bit over here, and this made more sense, and this, well, I don't believe this stuff here, so this over here. But it never, ever occurred to me that all this stuff is unbelievable. You know, I never made, never occurred to me that there's no God. It never occurred to me that was not an option. I always thought that, well, I got to find out which one is more correct than the other. So I kept searching and searching and searching. And it wasn't until, I guess it was back in 2006 when I started questioning the fact that, you know, the God, whether God exists or not. And I, on the internet, I came across this guy named Reginald Finley had this show on the radio. It was a podcast on the internet called The Infidel Guy. And when I started listening to some of his guests on this, some of the things they were saying, my eyes were open and I started researching and reading. And it still took me a couple of more years before I could really, you know, even though I didn't, this stuff is, you know, I don't buy this stuff anymore. But it still took me a couple of more years to do that, to come out and say that I'm an atheist. And so when I brought that to my children, as I said before, they said, well, there's no other atheist. So I, you know, I got together with all my Facebook friends and called them on the telephone, and I visited, spent the wee hours in the morning talking about their path to non-belief. Some of them came from religious families, some of them didn't. Some were raised secular, and they all wrote their stories, and I have 30 of them in this book, and every one of them are Black. And that's why I wanted to put this together, so to show not only to my children but to all other Blacks that you're not alone. There are other Black folks that you don't have to be religious just because you're Black.
Yeah, that's, and we've been talking for folks that didn't get to make it to the celebration this weekend. One of the things that's been a recurring theme is that when Black folks get to a point where they're questioning their religion, there's not a lot of specifically Black information out there about the stories of other Black people.
Right, right.
And so you're fixing that.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. That's my favorite part of this weekend about meeting the authors that we're interviewing for this show, is that you guys saw something that needed to be changed and you fixed it.
Right.
You're working on it.
Yeah,
tell me about, we're all a work in progress, right? Everything.
Yeah.
So family reunions in your house when y'all get together.
Yeah, you know, when we get together, you know, I'm pretty much the only one. You know, my daughter, the one that's the atheist, she lives in Cleveland, and the rest of my family, well, but they, you know, they come in, you know, like for Thanksgiving. Everybody was here for Thanksgiving except for my youngest daughter who lives in Cleveland. And nobody talks about religion because they understand and they know that if they talk about it, they're going to have to talk with me. And they don't want to talk with me.
Yeah.
So religion never comes up. We just never talk about it. And I am very grounded in the fact that I know that I stand on the side of truth, so I don't have any fear of discussing it with anybody, them, my children, anybody. So they won't talk with me about it because I don't know if they got their heads buried in the sand or they want to just continue to, can I just call them, they're pretending. They're just pretending to know things that they don't know. So they just continuously pretend, and I'll just let them continue to pretend unless they come to me and talk to me and ask me about it. They want to talk. Or I'll give you a case in point. My daughter was here from New Orleans. She came and they hung out the Stone Mountain, and she bought a T-shirt that said, "Play hard, pray hard." And the whole weekend I was trying to maneuver myself around so I could just be but a one-on-one. I didn't want to do it in front of everybody else. I want to have a one-on-one conversation with her, but I never got a chance to talk to her about it. But I was going to ask her, what did that mean and how, explaining. I guess that would open it up for me. So that was something she was doing, not me. So that's the approach that I take. So.
That is a strange phrase. I'm not even sure I can figure out what that means. We'll let it rest.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll come up one day and you can put that in the next book.
Yeah.
So where can our listeners find your book?
You can go to www.blacknuns.wix.com/you-are-not-alone.
Okay.
And then you can
so that's W-I-X, Wix, right?
Wix,
okay,
Wix.
Excellent.
Com, right. Or go to my Facebook page. I have a fan page. It's facebook.com/author Daryl C. Smith.
Okay. And folks, that's Daryl, D-A-R-R-E-L-L.
Yeah.
So two R's, two L's.
Right.
Smith. Perfect. All right, Daryl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim, for talking to me.
This was great. Yeah. I'm so glad that you're one of the people making a difference. This is great. It's exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
If you haven't already, check out the American Humanist Association website at AmericanHumanist.org for information on the upcoming annual conference this May in Chicago. This is American Humanist's 75th anniversary conference, and it promises to be something special. Keep your eye on the site for more announcements, or register and reserve your room now before the hotel sells out. As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.